Welcome to Let My People Think, the weekly program featuring the speaking ministry of Christian apologist Ravi Zacharias. For the past 4 weeks, our program format has been a bit different in order to accommodate a series of programs called the Top 5 Questions. We'll conclude this series today as we hear from not only Ravi Zacharias, but also from another Christian apologist, Dr. William Lane Craig. Ravi and Dr. Craig had the privilege of participating in a conference held on the campus of the University of Iowa, where they were asked to respond to the top 5 questions that university students ask about Christianity. When we left off last week, the speakers had begun answering questions from the floor, questions in addition to the top 5 questions. Today, the speakers will address some issues that come up often in discussions about the Christian faith, such as, how does the Christian explain violence and oppression that has been committed in the name of Christ? How does a Christian who holds to an exclusive faith approach a world of so many different beliefs? We'll begin with Dr. Craig's answer to the question, why can't we have morals without God? Here's Dr. Craig.
With respect to my claim that if there is no God, then objective moral values do not exist, I guess I could say a couple of things there. First, with respect to moral values, it just seems to me that on an atheistic worldview, there just isn't any reason to think that there would be these sort of non-natural moral properties that exist, because all you've basically got is matter and energy and its different configurations and the different properties that arise from that. I just don't see why, in that case, human beings would be the locus of objective moral values as opposed to just guinea pigs or any other form of matter that has evolved into a biologically complex form. And in addition to that, with respect to the moral law, I don't see how this would provide for us moral duties. Even if you said there's some sort of an abstract good, say some sort of a virtue that exists or justice exists as an abstract form or principle, how would that relate to me in terms of moral duties, my oughtness, that I ought to do certain things, that I have a moral obligation to do things? It seems to me that that's much more understandable on the divine law theory that Ravi laid out, where we have obligations to obey divine commands. We're under a duty to obey a law. It would be just like we have political obligations to obey laws that have been passed by governments, or we have, say, obligations that are societal if we're in a certain community to obey. And similarly, the idea of moral obligation doesn't make sense to me unless there is a sort of moral law giver and who commands us to do these things and to whom we therefore have this obligation. So I'm not persuaded that on an atheistic view you can offer a successful defense of moral duties and rights and wrongs as well as objective moral values.
I'm not quite sure where your rationale is in dealing with the two of the issues, and maybe you can help clarify it for me. Viktor Frankl's statement is a very logical one. The logical one is that the ideas preceded the actions. I don't think he is saying anything other than that. He is not saying it was purely a militaristic decision. He was saying it was an idea of humanity and the nature of human beings that was prior to the action that resulted. Stalin was once upon a time a seminary student, gave up his belief in God and left seminary and began to, with an iron fist, rule his own people, had a direct bearing, his ideas, upon the consequences and so on. So I think Frankl's statement stands on its own. I don't think Frankl is thereby saying that the engineers of that had no blame. I think he said the ideas were prior to the operation that ensued. Secondly, I'm really very curious to see where you would peg your objective moral values outside of God. I'd love for a Hindu and a Muslim and a Buddhist to be sitting here and seeing if they would agree with your version of a transcendent ethic, apart from a clearly stated objective moral framework to which a Hindu and a Muslim and a Buddhist would agree. who themselves would say they have a completely different natural law operating within themselves. Gautama Buddha, for example, who was non-theistic, his view of ethics would be radically different to Kant's view of ethics, who was trying to also frame it in a non-transcendent framework. So I think where I would love to have the time with you is to see how you would put, I would assume that when you say an objective moral value, that it is something that rises above you and is a common point of reference for all of humanity to refer and by which to order their lives. Am I right in assuming that?
Well, since I've been asked those questions, I'll be glad to respond very briefly. First of all, it had better not be the case that the criterion here is whether I can get everybody to agree with me, because you won't get everybody to agree with you either. If you ask me what the purely naturalistic basis for an ethics could be, of course I have any number of theories to choose from. I can tell you that my own view is a type of Aristotelian naturalism, if that tells you very much. There are deontic theories that speak directly to the question of obligation. There are theories that say that it is reason itself that tells you what you are obliged to do, what you're obligated to do. Both of you, I assume, are at least to a considerable extent quite familiar with those theories. It won't do to settle that issue simply to say that the only theory that seems to satisfy you is one which invokes a deity. One needs some sort of reason to think that such a theory is in fact better. I happen to think that divine command theories are extraordinarily difficult to defend for a variety of reasons. With respect to Viktor Frankl's point...
Can I just ask, how is that objective?
How is what objective?
How is your Aristotelian view an objective framework?
It is a framework that depends on objective facts about the nature of human beings and human life.
That's not an objective viewpoint.
It's as objective as it possibly could be. There just are objective facts about that.
No, you're arguing. I think you're arguing in a circle. You have assumed the nature is self-explanatory.
No.
A Hindu or a Muslim would say to you, or a Christian would say to you, no, the human nature issue is not settled.
Oh, it may not be settled, and to the extent to which it's not settled, it may not
be
entirely...
Then it's not objective, is it?
It may not be entirely known what the objective moral values are. But then... Christians haven't settled among themselves what the objective moral values are either.
I just think my point still stands. I don't hear you presenting an objective framework, but go ahead with the Frankl comment.
There are a couple of just quick points I want to make. One is that Nietzsche, as you know, was no anti-Semite. Another is that though clearly some of the leaders who perpetrated the Holocaust were themselves not Christians, that isn't entirely the question. The question is whether they could possibly have succeeded had it not been for a climate of anti-Semitism, a very powerful climate of anti-Semitism that existed in Europe. Where did that climate derive from? I agree with you that the ideas come first, and the question is whose ideas were primary motivating factors in the Holocaust.
I think you're raising a very sobering issue. I agree with you that there was a climate that lent itself to some of that, but let us not forget that in the study of it, there were many even from a Jewish background who fell in line and assisted the process. That's one of the most painful aspects of understanding what all transpired. But that moves me neither here nor there. I think you have to be very careful when you lay at the doorstep what you're talking about, a climate. It is like the Indian person in India saying the Christian came from England and robbed India of its own autonomy and became dominant over other people. That was hardly a reflection of what Christ taught. And I would like to point out very, very carefully here that when a person gets involved in this kind of dastardly activity, as mind-boggling, sir, as it is to you and to me, we need to be very careful to see that it is not the logical outworking of the gospel. It may be the abuse of the gospel. It may be the illogical working of people in the name of political power. But by the same token, millions more have been slaughtered in the name of atheism, which sometimes logically worked out from its first principles that man was nothing more than time plus matter plus chance. In fact, I would even go so far as to suggest, I'm trying to remember the last name of George, the author, it'll come to me, the one who wrote The Portage from San Cristobal of A.H. You may have read his book, George Steiner, The Portage from San Cristobal of A.H., Adolf Hitler, in which his version, and here's a Jewish writer who thinks maybe what Hitler actually had in mind in his final solution was to obliterate the people who symbolized to him the moral law and the moral law giver. So certainly that's a very dramatic statement for him to make. And the last words of Eichmann confirmed what, as he was walking to the gallows, and the minister even offered him services, when Peter Malkin, the Jewish Mossad person who helped bring Eichmann from Argentina to trial, Malkin has disclosed the hours of conversation he had with Eichmann. Eichmann's son is today teaching, as you know, at Tübingen University. Not one of them has laid the blame on the Christian worldview for what they did. It was the downward spiraling of power that energized them. And whatever else happens, Christianity, I come from a part of the world where I often have to deal with these issues. Christendom has a very sad history. I have never run from that. It is one of the saddest things to read, not just in Jewish history, but even in Arab history, you read the struggle they have had with this. But the point that we need to make, and then we'll give someone else a chance here, we'll be glad to stay and talk with you, because I think your questions are very pertinent, that we have to be careful that we don't lay at the feet of Christ what a politicized version of Christianity did. And any time the Christian faith becomes politicized, it runs the danger of doing the same thing all over again. So what I think Professor Craig and I are doing here, we're not defending Christendom's history. It is the person of Christ that we want to defend. And whatever happened in the Holocaust was not because of what he said or did or taught. And I think we have to be fair with the teaching on that. And I still stand with Frankl's statement that ideas have consequences. And I still believe that in a secularistic framework, whether one goes to Dewey or one goes to Ayn Rand or one goes to Diderot or one goes to Hume or one goes to Kant, the ability to defend an objective frame of ethics is just, it continues to argue in a circle, because purpose is always intrinsic to defining evil and good. And if purpose itself is denied in human existence, I don't see how good and evil. Tennyson's Nature Red in Tooth and Claw is very definitive of how we have arrived where we are.
Okay. Living in a world where there is a pluralism of religions and faiths and no faiths, and saying that I have the truth, I am right, and you are wrong, creates social conflict. I'm thinking, Christians have, Mr. Zacharias has addressed that just a bit, have been guilty of being involved in that conflict. I want to know, first of all, as a Christian, how do you live among competing worldviews in terms of attitude and action? And secondly, the charge that my father-in-law always brings is that if Jesus makes so much difference personally, why does it not make more difference socially in terms of, he will point to different things that the Christians have done down through the years. And that, for him at least, the social aspect outweighs an intellectual argument for him. And I particularly would like to hear from Dr. Zacharias, because especially from his background?
I think in a voluntarily pluralistic society, as America is, it is imperative that we recognize our differences and accept one another's differences. It is just part of a society that we have brought here. I have lived in countries that call themselves secular but do not give you the privilege at the same time of believing whatever you do. And even for a very vivid example, even though India is called a secular society, I grew up in my university days and my high school days. The rooms were full of Eastern deities. It didn't bother me. I didn't want them out of there. There was a predominance of that belief in the country. But it is very interesting, I find sometimes now, when many Hindu friends maybe would come over here, and if a Christmas tree is put somewhere in some government building, I've had telephone calls made to me on talk shows that is a symbol of a religion that needs to be removed, while at the same time living in those lands, not just the symbols, but the teachings and the quotations from Scripture. And I accepted that. It was all right. And America, being a voluntarily pluralistic society, we need to accept the fact that there are differences in belief. But I do not believe we are called upon to celebrate those different belief systems. And there's a world of a difference between the two. I cannot celebrate a lifestyle that is morally wrong for me. I may give the person the privilege of living that way, but I do not believe that it is imperative for me to celebrate that lifestyle and that choice. The wheels of law and the wheels of history will somehow move and move slowly. And we hope in the second part of your question, what your father-in-law raised, I think there will be an answer. Now, having said that, in the social framework, because I was used to living and we are used to living with different views, here is the fundamental problem. There are two motifs with which we live, egalitarianism and elitism. Egalitarianism meaning equality, elitism meaning a hierarchy or a superiority. I believe in the biblical framework, this is my understanding of it, and I may be wrong, both are present. The egalitarianism is present in people. We are all created, made after the image of God. I cannot despise a person's color. I cannot despise a person's ethnic background, and I love this world of numerous cultures. I've raised my children to love all other cultures, to embrace them. I'm a world traveler. There's an egalitarianism of our fellow human beings, but there is an elitism in ideas in the Bible. It tells me that not all ideas are equally true. Some are false and some are true. Now, in the humanistic framework, we have reversed that. In effect, what we have now got is an egalitarianism of ideas and an elitism of people. There is kind of an elitist group that can control one's thinking. Now, here is a question that I have as a person coming from the East, possibly a question that troubles me more on the Western campuses than any other question. I have studied in Cambridge. I studied under English philosophers and under Indian philosophers. I have heard the English philosophers make numerous attacks upon the Christian faith, numerous vilifying attacks while you're sitting in the classroom, often tendentious, often unsubstantiated. Never heard one Western professor ever make a comment negatively on Hinduism or Buddhism or Islam. And I have to ask the question, why? I'm not saying any of it is justified. I'm just asking why one is singled out. I never heard my professors make any comment to the same degree of any other system. I don't think one ought to make that. Even here when we are asked questions, I try to be very careful and only deal with issues of fact as they are different. Now, here I think is a way to solve the dilemma. Why cannot the Christian belief, as it is biblically authentic, be given free access in our universities also and be taught rather than be vilified and attacked? I know professors of philosophy at the University of Toronto who opened their lectures by saying, if any one of you is a Christian here, I'm going to bash it out of you before this class is over. I had a PhD student phone and ask me how to even handle this. Courses at Princeton are doing the same thing. If that's what academia allows, all right. Why does not academic fairness then allow also for a presentation of the authentic Christian faith rather than a caricature of it? The last issue on the social frame, that is a great struggle. to see why it is that individual lives claim to be changed while society itself does not change. But history tells the other side of the story too. In 18th century England, while the French Revolution was storming France, even Winston Churchill and the secular historian Lecky made the comment that had it not been for the Wesleyan and the Whitfield revivals, chances are England too would have been destroyed by a revolution at that point. And the Holy Spirit has a restraining hand. I strongly suspect if you pull away any Christian worldview from America, I think your father-in-law will see what the difference will be when that sort of a worldview is completely gone. His point is still well taken. But where do I begin? I can't begin by going to the Supreme Court and changing laws. This is a pluralistic society. I begin by living the Christian life in my home, by honoring my commitment to my wife, by being faithful as a father, and pouring my life into those that God has entrusted me with. And from that, by the logical flow, society can change, and then the more radical issues can be dealt with. And one way I think that we are showing in that direction is that we can discuss in these forums without hopefully venting hostility one to another, but giving a chance to hear in a reasonable setting where our thinking is.
We're going to just take one last question from this gentleman here on the left.
My question is for Dr. Craig, and it concerns the moral objectivity that we've been talking about and discussing. Is it your view that moral law is decreed by God, that is, that it is decreed by God by his fiat, as Bertrand Russell said, and that from that we can assume that God is neither moral or immoral, that he is rather amoral, neither good or evil? Or is it your view that moral law exists independently of God and that he acts as a moral and good agent within that framework?
My view would be to split the horns of that dilemma and affirm neither of those alternatives, both of which I think have obvious difficulties. I would hold to what Thomas Morris has called Anselmian theism, that is to say, after the pattern of what St. Anselm argued, and that is that what Plato called the good, the locus and the source of value, is the very nature of God himself, so that the divine commands, which are our moral duties, flow necessarily out of the moral nature of God himself. Therefore, they are neither something above God to which God is subservient, nor are they arbitrarily willed by God capriciously, but rather they're necessary expressions of God's own nature. He is by nature just, loving, kind, virtuous, and so forth, all the other sorts of moral qualities that we could think of. And that these commands then become for us our moral duties. Now, if you were to say, but why think that God is the locus of value, that he himself is the good? Well, I think it would flow from the very concept of God. It would be a metaphysical necessity. That is to say, God, by definition, is a being worthy of worship. And only a being which is absolute goodness is worthy of being worshipped. Anything that was merely finite in value or only partially good or participated in goodness, but was not the locus and absolute embodiment of goodness itself, could not be something that could merit worship in all that that word connotes. And therefore, I think that we have good and coherent grounds for grounding our system of ethics in God. And if you deny the existence of God, then it seems to me that you're basically left with a closed system in which it's very, very difficult to see how there would be moral values which would be trans-cultural in their binding force on us rather than just the socio-cultural byproducts of human development. It's very hard for me to see how you can have an objective ethic without a transcendent ground for it. So that would be the way I would answer your question. If you're interested in reading more, look at Thomas Morris's very fine book called Anselmian Explorations. in which he deals with some of these questions in a couple of chapters of the book.
That was William Lane Craig with Ravi Zacharias on the campus of the University of Iowa, answering questions from the students and faculty there. Let's review what our speakers touched on today. Both speakers explain that moral values can't exist apart from God. If all we have in the universe is matter, then morals would be nothing more than arbitrary byproducts of evolution. But we know that some things are objectively right or wrong, which points us to a moral God. On the issue of Christians committing violence, Ravi said that although it is very sad, it was not at all in line with what Christ himself taught. Ravi also spoke about tolerance, saying that one can peacefully acknowledge other belief systems and lifestyles without sacrificing their own convictions. Please join us again next week. Today's broadcast, The Top 5 Questions, is available through Ravi Zacharias International Ministries as part of a 2-tape album. The album features the complete responses of Dr. Zacharias and Dr. William Lane Craig to the top 5 questions asked by university students about Christianity. It also features an open session in which the speakers answer questions from the audience. When ordering, ask for tape number CA210, The Top 5 Questions. That's CA210, The Top 5 Questions. If you listen in the United States, place your credit card order by calling 1-800-448-6766. That's 1-800-448-6766. The order line is available 24 hours a day. When you place your order, ask for your free copy of Ravi's newsletter, Just Thinking. The newsletter contains articles by Ravi and members of his ministry team that can be a helpful tool for understanding the issues of our day. To order online, go to rzim.org. That's rzim.org. There you'll find information about Ravi's ministry, essays and articles, and archived files of the Let My People Think broadcasts. The Online Resource Center is an interactive, user-friendly way to preview and order resources. Once again, that's rzim.org. If you prefer to write, address your envelope to RZIM, Post Office Box 921-939, Norcross, Georgia, 30010. That's RZIM, Post Office Box 921-939, Norcross, Georgia, 30010. In Canada, contact our office there at 2476 Argentia Road, Suite 203, Mississauga, Ontario, L5N6M1. That's RZIM, 2476 Argentia Road, Suite 203, Mississauga, Ontario, L5N6M1. Please be sure to give us the call letters of the station when you contact us. Knowing which station you're listening to can help us better evaluate the effectiveness of the broadcast. This weekly program, Let My People Think, is a listener-supported radio ministry and a production of Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, Atlanta, Georgia.